offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and as always, it is my pleasure to join you all on this beautiful Thursday morning from our Sri Satya Sai Media Center. We just started the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita a couple of weeks back, and we're going to continue with that. As we've been seeing, it's a very beautiful chapter like the previous one and the ones before that too. The speciality of this chapter and the previous one is that Krishna speaks in detail about the nature of Brahman, the nature of divinity, and he speaks of most of these shlokas in the first person, where he says, you have to think of me, I am this, this is my nature, so on and so forth. So we will begin with the short summary of what we covered last time, and we'll take it on from there, because the shlokas that we're going to go through today are also in reply to a question that Arjuna asked right in the beginning. So we covered two shlokas last time, 3 and 4, and as I just mentioned, these are in response to a couple of questions that Arjuna had asked right in the beginning of the 8th chapter, and the questions were born out of a few terms that Krishna used in the end of the previous chapter: Adhibhutam, Adhiyajna, Adhyatma, and Adhidhaiva. And from the answer, it appears that Arjuna did have an idea about these words. It is not like he was completely unaware, like me or some of you. He did have an idea of what these terms refer to, but he was asking about what they really meant and why did Krishna use them in the context that he did. That's why Krishna's answers themselves are very crisp, but we had to study more deeply because, as I said, we are not acquainted with these terms in the first place. So Arjuna had also asked about karma and the thoughts at the time of death. That is something that we will cover today, the thoughts at the time of death. But coming back to what Krishna answered in those previous verses that we covered, Krishna begins by explaining, saying, Aksharam Brahma Paramam Swabhavaha Adhyatmam Uchyate. That supreme indestructible Brahman's Swabhava is Adhyatma. Adhyatma is the true self in each entity that is God by negating everything that is only a temporary layer, right? And the first statement that Krishna makes is Swabhava of Brahman is this Adhyatma. We discussed this in detail by going through the concepts of Asti, Bhati and Priyam being the same as Sat, Chit, Ananda of the Brahman. And this was very beautifully explained by Gita Vaini, and much of last week's episode had huge chunks of readings from Gita Vaini because Swami had explained it so beautifully, and I can not do any better justice than by quoting it directly. In the next line he says, Bhuta Bhavod Bhavakaro Visargaha Karma Sanyataha. That Tyaga, which is the cause for birth and sustenance, is what is called karma. Swami then went on to explain how the divine sankalpa of having creation is the seed for all karmas that came thereafter, and hence all karmas have a divine origin in that sankalpa, and hence all karmas are divine. In the 4th shloka, Krishna speaks about Adhibhuta and Adhidaiva. He says, Adhibhutam Kshaurabhavah. What is referred to as Adhibhuta is nothing but my perishable nature. Now, after saying Brahman is Akshara, here is Krishna saying that all beings that come and go, that have a destructible nature, they are part of my perishable nature, Kshaurabhavah. We then went through Swami's beautiful explanation where he says the food that constitutes these beings. When you talk about our body, it is made of food. That food comes from the 5 elements. The 5 elements themselves are a product of Maya, and Maya is a product of God's will. And this separation of God being separate from the creation itself is that Maya, right? Itself is that illusion. And how can we state that the beings that come and go are separate from God? So that was the explanation that Swami gave. A very similar explanation explains how God is Adhi Daiva, the various deities. When we say Adhi Atma, it means the essence of all individuals, beings. When we say Adhi Daiva, it means the essence of the various deities that we speak of governing the various forces of nature. Swami explained that the Supreme is existent in all as the Hiranyagarbha aspect, right? It is it's an unmanifest form of this divine, which is filled with potential energy to become anything, right? That's what is the best definition of Hiranyagarbha. So Swami says, the Purusha, the Lord, is present as Hiranyagarbha, and these various deities are nothing but the various indriyas, karmendriyas and jnanendriyas for this Purusha. And that is how the statement, the Purusha himself is Adhidaiva, is explained. Krishna concludes the shloka by saying, Adhi yajnaha aham eva atra dehe deha bhratam vara. I alone am Adhi yajna here in the body. The explanation Swami gives for this statement is that Krishna is clearly declaring that he alone is the prompter of actions, hence he is the doer. He alone is the one who accepts the offerings. When you say Adhi yajna, it means that being which accepts offerings that are performed during the yajna. So Krishna says, I am the one who promotes the sacrifice or promotes the idea of the sacrifice. I am the one who accepts the sacrificial offering. So I am the karta and the bhokta. And that is how Krishna says that as that Adhi yajna, I am existent in each body. And we saw how this is very close to the concept of the Brahmarpanam Shloka and the Aham Vaishvanaro Bhutva, which we chant as our food prayer. So these were the verses that we went through, two verses. The first two verses that Krishna gives as answer to the question that Arjuna has asked, but the answer is still not complete. There are a few more concepts that Arjuna asked about, primarily about the last thoughts when one is about to discard this human body. So we'll come to that shloka, the shloka number 5. We will listen to that. It has been rendered beautifully in the voice of Brother Shyam. I'll give you a brief meaning of that. And then we will discuss in detail this very, very important concept of the thoughts with which we end this sojourn called life.
Antakale cha mameva smaran muktva kalevaram yah prayati samadbhavam yati nastyatra samshayah.
And at the time of death, anyone who departs by giving up the body while thinking of me alone, he attains my state. There is no doubt about this. That is the 5th verse of the 8th chapter. Just as I was summarizing, while concluding the previous chapter, Krishna had made a few statements, and this chapter is a follow-up of that, and these few shlokas are an elaboration of those statements. One statement that he makes that has Arjuna particularly baffled, and that is, even at the time of death, this knowledge will be with the person. So Arjuna had asked, Prayana kale cha katham nyeyosi niyatatmabihi. And how at the time of death are you to be known by the niyatatmas, the self-controlled? What is so great about knowing or remembering God at the time of death? Is it really in one's control as to what one thinks at that critical time? And what happens if one thinks of God in those last moments. Krishna clarifies in the shloka with an emphatic declaration. He says, cha and antakale, at the final moments or time of death, mameva smarana, remembering me alone, muktva kalevaram, who gives up the body. Kalevaram means body. Muktva kalevaram, who gives up this body, yaha prayati, who departs in this manner, sa mat bhavam yati, he reaches my bhava. Na asti atra samshayah, there is no doubt about this. So here is a very categorical promise given by Krishna. Na asti atra samshayah, he says. There is no doubt about this. The word samshaya is again something that we have come across earlier too. It means doubt. It also means uncertainty or risk. So Krishna is saying there are no exceptions to this. This is not a gamble. If you think of me in your last moments, you certainly reach me, right? Na samshaya. There is no two ways of talking about this or thinking about this. This is not a gamble. This is not something that is uncertain. A few days back, a youngster asked me this question. Krishna says, and Swami also says, that thinking of God, when you die, you reach God. So what if a person commits suicide and thinks of God while dying? Will that work? There are a lot of interesting hidden hints in this shloka and a shloka that Krishna mentioned in the previous chapter. And all of this is closely knit with what Krishna has explained in the previous chapter, he's going to explain. So to start with, when such questions arise, right? Can we do like this? Can we do like that? Is there any cheat code to crack this, right? Because what Krishna is saying here is very important. He's saying, all it takes is to think of me just when you die, and you're going to reach me, right? That's an enormous statement to make. So the mind starts asking all of these questions, like that youngster asked, right? First of all, this is Krishna's promise. So there is no challenging that. I am not going to say, well, Krishna says so, but you know, having said that, you never know, right? I'm not going to do that, because this is Krishna's promise. This is Swami's promise. There is no doubting this. But having said that, we must also remember that an avatar's words are always more profound than we can comprehend right away. It has layers of meanings, and it is up to each one of us to delve deep and come to the essence of that. For instance, Swami says, all that you have to do is just follow one teaching of Swami. Don't worry about anything else. Just one teaching of Swami you follow, and that is enough. But then, in trying to follow that one teaching, you will find that you cannot do that unless you're following every word of Swami. You will eventually end up following every maxim that Swami gives us. Swami says, love all. It seems like such a simple thing, two words, right? But is it ever possible to love all if you have not given up kama, krodha, lobha, matsarya and everything? Without patience, purity and perseverance, can you love all? So you should be able to peel through the different layers of meanings when the avatar gives a statement like this. This is again not to say that Swami's words are not easy to follow, right? You don't have to wonder, Krishna is making it so simple and this fellow is trying to scare us by telling all this. No, that is again not the idea of what I'm trying to say. The point is, we should take these words with the due acknowledgement of profundity that the Lord's words call for, right? Because it is always okay to err on the side of caution rather than to err on the side of complacency when it comes to going through Swami's words. So questions like, can I lead a luxurious life? Let me pursue the world and all the luxuries the world has. And then in the last few years, I'll go and settle down in an ashram. Then I'll do japam regularly. And then automatically in the last moment, I will think of God. Or questions like, you know, do I have to think of Krishna only? Can I think of Rama or Jesus or Allah? Or, you know, you worship one deity all your life and then towards the end you start thinking of Krishna because Krishna is told only if you think of me. So that we may not misunderstand Krishna's words and also so that we don't take it lightly and to make best use of this hint, the most important hint that Krishna is giving us, I think it is necessary to acknowledge that the avatar's words are very deep and profound and we should not take it lightly. We'll start with a sweet little chinnakatha that Swami would often narrate to answer such questions, right? I mean that the mind is capable of coming up because we're always like that. We're always looking for the easy way out. Most of you must have heard this chinnakatha from Swami himself. The story goes that there was this businessman who heard in a discourse, in a spiritual discourse, about the story of this character called Ajamila. Again, for those of you who are not familiar with the story, I'm sure most of you would be. But in case somebody is out there who is listening, who is not too sure about the story of Ajamila, I'll very briefly narrate it. The story of Ajamila is from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Sukha Maharshi narrates the story to reiterate the importance of Namasmarana and more importantly Namasmarana in the last moments, the concept that we're talking about. So Ajamila was a very pious Brahmin. He had a family, children and wife and parents. He would take care of them. He would perform all his religious duties. He was a typical good individual. One day he happens to cast his eye upon a woman of ill repute. He falls for her. Then he abandons his family. He goes away with this lady. He settles with her. And with this woman, he again fathers 10 children. And now to provide for this family, it is not possible for him to stick to dharmic ways. So he takes to wrong means. He starts cheating people. He starts gambling and doing such things. In short, he starts leading a very despicable life, moving away from the dharmic life that he was leading. Of his 10 children, he's particularly fond of this youngest child, last son of his, whom he names Narayana. So whenever he would come home, he would first thing he would do is call out to his son Narayana. When he would sit to eat, he would call out to Narayana to sit next to him. Before he goes to sleep, he will go by the side of his son Narayana and he would be the last person he would see. So he was very attached to this last child of his. So the story goes at one point, he becomes old, his last moments come, and even when he is about to die, he's lying on his deathbed, he calls out to his favorite son, Narayana, and he dies. After he has left his mortal coil, the story goes that the messengers of Yama come to take the soul to hell because he has led a life which is so bad. But just when that is about to happen, Lord Narayana's servitors come there and stop these Yamadutas and tell them that he cannot be taken to hell. He'll have to come with us to Vaikuntha because he has taken the name of Narayana just before dying. So this is the story of Ajamila from the Srimad Bhagavatam. And as a story, when you listen to it, I know there are many questions that can arise. And it is quite understandable that it is a story which can cause a lot of confusions and, one can be led to taking wrong conclusions. So one such person is this businessman that Swami speaks of in the Chinnakatha. So there is this businessman who listens to the story. He's highly inspired by it. And like many of us, he says, oh, this is very simple. So I can do whatever I want all my life. I just have to ensure that I call Narayana's name in the end. So this businessman has 4 sons. And he chooses to name all of them after some god or the other, Rama, Krishna, Govinda, Narayana, let's say. So he is of the idea that he is sure to call all these fellows or one of these fellows at the time of death. And by proxy, he is going to be calling out to the Lord's name. And then the servitors of Narayana will come and protect him. So Swami says that this fellow is lying on this deathbed. He senses that his last moments are nearing, and then he starts calling out to his children, Rama, Krishna, Govinda, Narayana, and all his sons come running to his bedside. And the father, who is lying on his bed, who looks at all these four boys who have come to him, he says, if all four of you are here, then who's taking care of the shop? And at that moment, he dies. So his last thought is not about Rama, Krishna, Govinda, Narayana, or even his sons. His last thought is about the business that he has fostered all his life. Swami goes on to say, he says, all his life, his energy, his efforts, his dedication has all been invested in this business of his. So that is what came to his mind in the last moment. You might try to be smart and you can try to work around things like this, but whatever you have spent your life doing is what will come to your mind. So Swami says two things as morals for this story. One, as I said, only if you practice taking God's name throughout your life, you can take his name in the last minute. That is one of the most important morals Swami would relate after telling us the story. We'll just spend a little time on this before we go to the next lesson that Swami draws from the same Chinakatha. This is very similar to the science of stress and how especially sportsmen tend to use this concept. I think I mentioned this before, if not the whole thing, part of it I must have mentioned in this series. The human mind is given a very, very specific task, and it carries out this task through the organ, the physical organ called the brain. What is that task? To protect this self. Self-sustenance is the basic mandate given to this human brain. And as I said, the brain is nothing but a physical representative of this mind, right? So if you see how the brain functions with relationship to the rest of the body, you will find that you can correlate a lot of what happens in the mind too. So what happens when we are in situations of stress? When under stress, especially a life-threatening one, say we are face-to-face with a wild animal, or there is an earthquake and we have to run out into safety, at such times, the brain literally switches into a different mode of functioning. Just like how you have the energy saver modes in your computers or your gadgets, the brain starts shutting down all the non-critical functions. Functions of the body that you don't need at that critical moment. When you're running for life, there are some functions of the body that can wait or can be postponed, right? And some of these activities are very important on a normal day. But at that moment when your life is being threatened, probably it's not as important. Like digestion, reproduction, very advanced analytical thinking. Sometimes part of your memory is shut down. So the idea is the brain starts shutting down all of these other energy intensive activities, and it tries to direct all these energies to the limbs and other organs which are involved in what we refer to as a fight or flight response. So all these energies are diverted into probably your limbs so that you can quickly run out of there. I mean, at that moment, your digestion is not as important as you running out there, right? You have to stay alive for the food in your stomach digest. So this is a very, very beautiful mechanism in the human body itself. The only problem is we tend to become stressed in many, many situations in life, not necessarily only life and death situations. So when we are in that kind of a stressful state, physical state for extended periods of time, it leads to all kinds of other problems like indigestion, insomnia, and other stress-related disorders, right? That's why they say that being stressed is not good for your health. This is about the brain and how it responds to situations of stress. Talking about sports persons, right? When you talk about stress, as I said, it's not necessarily life and death. even when you're in a game situation, when you're playing a match, when you're, say, playing a cricket match, you're standing there, a leather ball is being hurled at you at 100 miles per hour. Automatically, the mind can only do a certain amount of thinking when put in that situation, right? So what the sportsmen do is, you know, when you're in that situation, you cannot think of the various kinds of shots you can play, how your feet have to move, what position your elbow has to be in, how you're supposed to, you know, transfer your weight from one leg to the other. Some of these things, I mean, if you're a follower of cricket, if you play a little bit of sport, you will understand what I'm saying. So all of these involve analytical thinking, and the mind is, the brain especially, is incapable of doing any of these thinking at that moment. So what do these sportsmen do? This is true not only for cricket, for all other sports, be it for tennis, be it for football. If you're a goalkeeper, right, you're always in such situations where the mind has to make multiple choices, but the mind is not capable of doing it under those situations. So what the sportspersons do is they indulge in enormous amounts of practice by which some of these movements, some of these strokes, some of these physical activities that have to be done to play a ball in a certain manner or throw the ball in a certain manner, these become reflex. The mind does not have to really analyze and think. It automatically does that. The moment the ball lands in a certain point, the leg moves in a certain manner. The moment the ball comes to you in a certain manner, you're playing tennis, your body takes that position of a forehand or a backhand or whatever the case there is, right? So these become so intertwined in the mind that the mind does not have to analyze it. Automatically does it as a reflex. We will come back to this. So this is one point. Now the mind has a slightly larger scope than the brain. The brain has to care for this body, right? The brain is always looking to sustain life in this body. But the mind has a larger idea of the self. When I say self, I not only mean this body, I mean this personality that I am, somebody is related to me, someone is my wife, someone is my husband, somebody is my mother and father, there are some people whom I relate to as my children. So this idea of the self becomes far more complex in the mind than it is for the brain. I'm just saying this to make it clear. I'm not saying that the mind is so different from the brain. I mean, it's very difficult to speak of it that manner. I'm just speaking it. I'm just explaining it in a way that it makes a little more sense. So when I'm talking about self-preservation or self-sustenance in the mind, it means preserving this idea of me and mine, this idea of self that this mind carries. My family, my profession, my friends, whatever I engulf into this idea of me has to now be protected by this mind. So when this life is threatened, when this mind is put in that stressful situation, the mind will only hold tight to those things that it believes is truly critical. And it starts letting go of those thoughts and those ideas which the mind believes or has come to believe is non-critical. If I dedicate every ounce of my energy and time to making money in life, I have been reiterating all through my life to my mind that money is the most important thing in life. So at the time of death, that is what the mind will hold on to, because you've trained the mind to think that money is most important. If all my life I've only been thinking about my wife, husband, children and grandchildren, the mind will let go of all other thoughts and will hold on to the thoughts about the family, because the mind has been trained to think that that is the most critical thing in life. The mind is made that way. It is not a flaw of the mind. It is a flaw of how we have trained the mind, right? So time of death is when this stress mode is turned on in the mind. There is no way the mind will give importance to God in those last moments if you have not programmed it through your life to think of God as being most important. So now putting together these two, one is making a habit of thinking of God. Attach God's name to every emotion. When happy, take his name. When sad, take his name. When afraid, take his name. When you feel negative, take his name. When you feel excited about something, take his name. Because that last moment is going to be so fresh. It's nothing like we've ever experienced. Though I've been speaking for so long about those last moments, I have no clue what it is. Right? It's only based on what we've read, what we've heard from Swami. So we never know what emotion is going to run through our mind in those last moments. But it doesn't matter, because for every emotion this mind has felt, if we make it a habit to take Swami's name and thereby think of Swami, it doesn't matter what emotion runs through our mind in those last moments. We might be happy, we might be scared, we might be worried, we might be tense. It doesn't matter, because every emotion will trigger Namasmarana in the mind and we'll think of Swami. The second point is a point we keep coming by, and we've discussed it many times earlier in the series too. Nitya Anitya Viveka Vichara. The discrimination between Nitya and Anitya, the real and the unreal, the ephemeral and the eternal. That Vichara, that thought, constantly contemplating on this Nitya Anitya Viveka. This constant contemplation, when it is done through life, the mind is going to let go of all things, as I said, that it is convinced is not critical, right? It automatically will happen. At the last moment, the mind will start letting go of all those things, the grudges that we have had, the fights that we have had, because at that moment, the mind will start thinking, oh, it's all worthless. Why am I going to hold on to this, right? So when all through my life, I have learned to discriminate between Nitya and Anitya, it is not that I stop pursuing a regular life, I stop pursuing luxuries, I stop pursuing money. But even as we go through life, if we develop this habit of constantly contemplating, this is after all unreal, this is after all passing, this is after all, for everything that comes to us, name, fame, insult, unhappiness, if we go through this process of Nitya Anitya Viveka Vichara, when the mind starts letting go of things in those last moments, it will effortlessly let go of all those things that you have convinced the mind to be Anitya. And it will automatically hold on to that one thing that you have convinced the mind to believe is Nitya, that is God. Automatically this will happen. So there is no cheat code here, right? There is no, that question that the youngster asked, can I do the heinous thing of killing myself and when I'm dying I'll think of God. Is that ever possible? Swami makes it very clear that you will not remember God in the last moments unless you make it a habit, unless you make it a practice. Right? But yes, if you think of God in the last moments, you will be freed, and that's a promise. Na atra samshayam. He says there is no doubt about that. But it calls for lifelong practice. So practice is the first conclusion that Swami draws from that particular story, the Chinnakatha. As the Swami draws two conclusions from that story, the other is, how do you know when death will come to you? What is the certainty that death will come only after you have turned 70, 80 or 90? Why, this very moment could be our last moment, isn't it? We never know. We never know when that last moment will come. You know, you think that, even if somebody is unwell, somebody is going through a long period of sickness, you never know whether that will be the last moment, right? There is this beautiful episode, I probably will not have time to go into that entirely. The great devotee of Swami, Mr. Seshagiri Rao, it so happened that at one point he was extremely sick. They thought that he was going to die and he was very unwell. And when people would go to meet him, he was reeling out shlokas from the Upanishads, which said that this body is unreal, the body is like a water bubble, it can be discarded, I am the Atman and all of that. And whoever came to his presence thought, oh my God, what a great soul. And that that he indeed is. I'm not saying that that is contested. They came to him, they said, what a great way to leave this world, thinking of all these great Upanishadic truths. But it so happened that he did not die at that moment. You know, he became well, Swami came and blessed him and he became well and he lived for a few months after that. So you never know when is it going to be the last moment. Can you manipulate your death? Can you choose? Though it appears like there is that choice always, but it is not so. So you never know what is that last moment and what will be the mind, state of mind in the last moment and what thoughts will go. So that's why Swami says, talking about this kind of preparedness of when death will come, Swami says in a discourse, and I quote, how do you know which moment is the last? Yama, the god of death, does not give notice of his arrival to take hold of you. He is like the man with the camera taking snapshots. He does not warn, ready, I am clicking. If you wish your portrait to hang on the walls of heaven, it must be attractive. Your stance, your pose, your smile must all be nice, is it not? So it is best to be ready for the click night and day, with the name ever tripping on the tongue and the glory always radiant in the mind. Then whenever shot, your photo will be nice. End of quote. So this is from a birthday discourse that Swami delivered in 1960. So sweetly Swami says, be ever ready for the cameraman called death. Swami says, this is the only thing you can ever be certain of. Is it not important to prepare for it? We all take life insurance just in case something untoward happens to us. But shouldn't we also think of this? Are we taking this afterlife insurance? Are we preparing for this moment? So when Krishna says, you will reach me when you think of me in the last moments, it is indeed absolute truth. He himself says, na asti atra samshayaha. There is no doubt about this. But to achieve that, one needs lifelong practice. But is there anything more to this? Is it merely about thinking of the name of Sai or Krishna? Is it merely thinking of that particular form of divinity? For this, we have to take a re-look at the 30th shloka of the previous chapter, where Krishna dropped the first hint. He said, if you recall, Sadhi Bhutadi Daivam Mam Sadhi Yajnam Cha Ye Viduhu Prayana Kalepi Chamam Te Vidur Yukta Chetasaha. Those who know me to be one with Adhibhuta, Adhidaiva and Adhiyajna know me even at the time of death with steadfast mind. And in the first few verses of this chapter, we saw what it is to know that he is one with all these things, Adhiyajna, Adhibhuta and Adhidaiva. In essence, this is to know God as being everything. Vasudeva Sarvam. When a devotee is in a state where he sees the Lord as being the be-all and end-all of everything, then the last moment is sanctified by thoughts of God. That is what Krishna had said in the 30th verse. Otherwise, all of spirituality doesn't make sense at all, whatever we've been speaking. I've repeated many times on this program a statement that Vedanta makes. There is no action, there is no thought, there is no word that can liberate a person. All these at best are sadhanas that prepare the mind by giving it chitta shuddhi. But no action, no single action or no single thought can liberate. Only wisdom can. Only when this ignorance that I am this body-mind complex, I am this jivatma goes, liberation is possible. This is what Vedanta says. And as we have been discussing through the previous chapter, this happens when we develop the understanding of who God is truly. So to summarize, yes, I will be liberated if I think of God in the last moments. But for that, the mind has to be in a state where it holds on to God at that critical moment when the physical world is being let go. Otherwise, the karana sharira or the causal body will direct this sukshma sharira or the subtle body into another body, right? Suitable for its actions. But when the physical is being given up, when the mind holds on to the universal, then there is no rebirth. And the mind will hold on to the universal only when it has attained that state where it seeks God and only God. And as Krishna explained in the previous chapter, for that one has to become a jnani. Right now we are artha, arthati, jignasu. We have come to God to satisfy our craving for the world. We have come to God. When we reach that state of a jnani, where we use the world to seek God, in that state, your mind is likely to think of God in that last moment, right? And when that happens, Krishna states, yah prayati sa madbhavam yati. One who lives like this, madbhavam, he reaches my nature. He becomes one with me. He becomes one with my nature. Right? So it's a very simple statement that Krishna makes, but it calls for lifelong practice. Right? And that is the journey that Swami has put all of us in, whether we like it or not, whether we asked for it or not. Swami has put us all in that path. And culmination or a representation of that is the Akhanda Bhajan that we do every year during Swami's birthday celebration season, right, which we're going to have this weekend. Because Swami says that Akhanda Bhajan that we do for 24 hours is actually Akhanda Bhajan, because you start and you stop. But it is to remind us that our entire life should become an Akhanda Bhajan. In fact, there is a later shloka which comes, which speaks of this, but we'll come to that maybe later. We'll now go to the next shloka, which is the sixth shloka, where Krishna is going to continue this concept of thoughts in the last moments. So we'll listen to the sixth verse. I'll give you a brief meaning and then we'll discuss in detail.
Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam tyajatyante kalevaram tam tamevaiti kaunteya sada tad bhava bhavitaha.
Whosoever at the end leaves the body, thinking of any being, to that being alone does he go. O son of Kunti, because of his constant thought of that being. So this is the sixth verse. In the previous verse, Krishna explained what happens when you think of God in the last moments. But what happens if you think of something else? And from what we saw, we all are pursuing so many things in life. We have so many interests. It's a good chance that we might be thinking of that. What happens in that case? Krishna states very clearly here, vapi, and also yam yam smarana bhavam, whichever thing thinking of, tyajati ante, leaves in the end kalevaram, this body, Kaunteya, O Arjuna, tam tam eva, that and that alone, eti, the person goes to or reaches, sada tad bhavam bhavati, bhavitaha, sorry, sada tad bhavam bhavitaha, having thought of it all the time. So having thought of something all the time, that is what you will think of in the last moments, and having thought of it in the last moments, that is what you will reach, is what Krishna states. This has multiple meanings and there are many parables that are narrated to explain this. When Krishna says, sada tat bhavam bhavat bhavitaha, having thought of it all the time, how do we think of something all the time? How is it likely that we are thinking of one thing all the time? It could be out of envy. It could be out of a sense of revenge. It could be possibly that, you know, there is somebody who is very talented and we've not envy in a negative sense, but we've envied that person. Oh, I wish I had a talent like that, right? Or you may be, and when you envy a talent like that, there's a possibility that next birth you will be born as talented as that person or with that talent. Or there are people who probably lacked money in this birth, did not have as much as they desired. So all the time they think that if only I had more money. And that is what will result in the next birth. Maybe you will be born a rich person, but that is the thought which is making you take that particular lifetime. There is the famous story of King Bharata in the Bhagavatam. He renounces everything. He's supposed to be a very, very dharmic ruler, a very pious king. He gives up everything at the appropriate time in his life and takes to a ascetic life, settles down in an ashram. But unfortunately, he rescues a baby deer in the forest and then ends up bringing up that deer as though he brings up his own child. So when he's in the last moments of his life, he starts thinking about that deer and wondering what that deer is doing and how that deer is going to fend. And because of that, he's born a deer, right? We have many, many such stories. There's a beautiful story that I'd heard once. There were two monks in an ashram. They were very good friends, very evolved aspirants too. So they had given up all attachments and desires. But one of these monks, who was very fond of one particular certain kind of berry, he was very advanced, he had given up all desires and leading a life of vairagya. But the traces of that desire was left in his mind. He was very fond of one kind of berry. The story goes that he's sitting in meditation and he's almost reaching the state of samadhi. He's going to give up his body. And just at that moment, there is a lady hawker who's going past the ashram and she's selling that very berry and she's calling out the name of that berry. And just when this person is giving up the body, he thinks of the berry and he dies. So this friend monk, who is also very evolved, it is said that through his divya drishti, through his divine vision, he realizes what has happened to his friend. So then he goes to the market the next day and he buys basketfuls of these berries and he brings it to the ashram and he takes every berry, he crushes it saying Narayana. He takes the next berry, crushes it saying Narayana. The reason is, he sees through his divine vision that this monk has thought of these berries in the last moment, and because he had kind of cleared all other vasanas, there were no other attachments, because of that final thought, the story goes that he is born as a worm in one of those berries, so that that berry becomes its life and everything, right? So this monk who realizes this buys all the berries in the market and crushes each one, looking for that friend who has now become a worm, calling out the name of Narayana, so that when he crushes that worm, the soul will be liberated from that body and it can move on in its journey. There are many stories like this. Don't ask me, is it really true? Does it really happen like that? What if you think of something else? Don't ask me all these questions. These are all stories. The idea that they convey is what you think of in the last moments is very, very important. And for that, you must refine your thoughts even when your life is fine, right? Even when you're living through life healthily and heartily. There's a very, very beautiful bhajan, and there's a small incident related to that bhajan. Many of you must have heard this bhajan. It's not a Sai bhajan, but it's a traditional Hindi bhajan. I'm not going to sing it for you and trouble you. I will just read out the lyrics. It's a very, very beautiful bhajan, one of my favorites. Must be one of the favorites to many of you listeners too. The lines of this bhajan goes, Itna tu karna swami, jab pran tan se nikle, Govind naam leke, tab pran tan se nikle. It means, O Lord, please do this much for me. When the life leaves my body, let me take the name Govinda and then let this life leave the body. Then the bhajan goes, Shri Ganga ji ka tat ho, Jamuna ka vanshi vat ho, Mera savara nikat ho, Jab pran tan se nikle. Whether it is on the banks of the Ganges or I might be in the shores of Yamuna, meaning I might be anywhere, this moment can come to me at any place, it doesn't matter where I am, but let my Krishna be next to me when life leaves this body. Then the line goes, Pitambari kasi ho, chavi man mein ye basi ho. Pitambari kasi ho, chavi man mein ye basi ho, honton pe kuch hasi ho, जब प्राण तन से निकले. लेट दैट ब्यूटिफुल फॉर्म क्लैड इन पीतांबर फिल माई आईज, फिल माई माइंड. लेट देयर बी अ जेंटल स्माइल ऑन माई लिप्स व्हेन लाइफ लीव्स दिस बॉडी. एंड देन वन ऑफ माई फेवरेट लाइन्स, ही सेज, उस वक्त जल्दी आना नहीं शाम भूल जाना. उस वक्त जल्दी आना नहीं शाम भूल जाना, राधे को साथ लाना जब प्राण तन से निकले. डू कम क्विकली एट दैट टाइम ओ लॉर्ड, डोंट फॉरगेट मी ओ श्यामा. ऑल्सो रिमेंबर टू ब्रिंग राधा अलोंग विद यू व्हेन लाइफ लीव्स दिस बॉडी. फाइनली द भजन एंड्स विद, एक भक्त की है अर्जी, खुद खर्ज की है घरजी, आगे तुम्हारे मर्जी जब प्राण तन से निकले. दिस इज अ प्रेयर ऑफ अ डिवोटी. इट इज अ सेल्फिश प्ली, इट इज अ सेल्फिश प्रेयर, बट आई प्लेस इट बिफोर यू. देर आफ्टर इट इज योर विल. देर आर ऑफ कोर्स अदर लाइन्स इन दिस भजन, इट्स अ मच लॉन्गर भजन. आई एम जस्ट पिकिंग आउट अ फ्यू ऑफ दीज लाइन्स, बट आई एम श्योर यू गेट द आइडिया दैट दिस इज द बेस्ट प्रेयर टू मेक. And for this to work, this is what you should have led your life in a manner leading up to. The life should have led up to this moment, isn't it? The reason I remembered this bhajan is, once there was a music program in Swami's presence, and a very famous bhajan singer was singing this bhajan in front of Swami. Swami was seated there, and around Swami some students were sitting. So when this singer was singing, and this singer is quite popular, he is very rich, he is married not once but many times. So when this singer was singing this bhajan, Swami looked around and Swami remarked, and in that remark was a lesson for everybody sitting around. Swami said, if you lead your life this way, how can you expect me to come to you in those last moments? How can you expect that you'll think of me in those last moments? Right? I'm not saying verbatim what Swami said, but this was the message that Swami was giving to all the students. Right? It is not about simply making a prayer. It's not about simply putting a wish in front of Swami. Whatever we have pursued, fancied, envied, have been passionate about is what will be given to us in the next lifetime. You see, many children today who are born with such enormous talent, in some past birth they would have passionately wanted it. They would have passionately looked at someone and said, oh, I wish I could be a singer like that. Oh, how I wish I could be a sportsman like that. And that is what materializes in the next birth. Once a student had asked Swami, you know, what kind of karma makes one a famous person? There are these singers and sportspersons whom we see who are world famous. Everybody knows them. Everybody recognizes them. So what kind of good karma one does in the past life that gives them such a birth where they are world famous? And Swami's reply was so simple and straight. Swami said, they aspired for it. That's all. That's all it takes. It is like you work all your life and you make a fortune. Some people buy property with the money they've made. Some choose to travel. Some choose to build a business. Some probably choose to do some charity. Maybe that's how even life is. We earn a lot of good karma in doing good work, leading a moral life. The question is, where do we want to spend that money? And that depends on what you've pursued all your life. So some choose fame. Some choose power. Some choose wealth. Some choose God. And when Krishna says that you will get what you think of, it is not a punishment, right? When Krishna says you think of me in the last moments, you'll reach me, it seems like a reward. And when he says that if you think of something else, you're going to go there, it seems like a punishment, but it is not so. It is only an opportunity to give up fancy for that particular thing that you have placed your mind on. When you have aspired for fame, when you go through a life of fame and you're able to hold on to your goodness, right? That is unspoken. That is needless to be mentioned. When you lead a good life, a moral life, a spiritual life, and then you go through a life of fame, you will see how empty fame is. Same is the case with money. Same is the case with beauty and everything else, with power and authority. You are given that life because you've aspired for it. And while going through that life, you will realize how trivial that is that you have asked for. Right? Bharata was given a life of a deer. It was not a punishment. It was so that that lesson can be learnt. And that is why the story goes that in the next birth he is born as Jada Bharata. He doesn't even want to express his scholarship because he feels that what is the point? It will only lead to ego and it will lead to name and fame, which I don't want. Right? That monk was given a birth of a worm to once and for all finish that craving that he had, right? It is not that he was punished for that one single thought. You've lived 60, 70 years of your life as an ascetic and one thought and you made a worm. It is not punishment. It is an opportunity that is given so that you can overcome that, right? And for that, this spiritual sadhana that we so much speak about is so very, very important. Even as we go through life, this nitya anitya vichara, as we have spoken about, what is real, what is unreal, what is really important in life, even as we are enjoying wealth, even as we are enjoying name and fame and power and authority, is it really so important? Is this more important or is God more important? So this thought has to be constantly kept in mind so that in those last moments, automatically the mind will just let go of these things that you have trained it to think as unimportant. So this is one reality in life we all must prepare for. We often think it is inauspicious to talk about death, but then isn't it absurd not to prepare for this one moment that is certain in our life? Swami says in a discourse, there are two things that you must not forget in life. I'll probably read out that small passage. Swami says, and I quote, there are two things that you must always remember and not forget. God is one and death is one. In whatever manner you may look at them, these two are the eternal truths. If you do not want to go to a marriage, you can cancel the engagement. Similarly, if you do not want to go to a cinema, you can postpone it for the next day. But the last journey, the journey to your death, can neither be cancelled nor be postponed. We make preparations when we want to go for a marriage or a cinema. What preparations are we making for this final journey? End of quote. This is from Swami's 1972 Summer Showers. Through our actions and our devotion, we must earn this boon that Swami will come to our mind. His name will be on our lips and he will be by our side when life departs from this body. Right? This entire life is nothing but a preparation for that moment. He should be drawn to our presence when this moment comes in our life. And his entire life is nothing but a preparation for that. Right? These are very, very important two verses, these two verses, because this is a promise that Krishna is giving. To think of me in those last moments, and so very beautifully Swami says, and this entire concept of Karma Yoga, Bhagavad Gita speaks about, we will of course continue that in the next verse, where Krishna clearly states that how this can be achieved. How will you think of God in those last moments? In the next verse especially, it's a very, very beautiful and very poignant verse. We will come to that next week when we take it up. But these two verses and what Krishna is saying here is so very, very important. So with these thoughts, I'll offer this entire program at Swami's Lotus Feet. I thank each one of you for your very, very patient listening. And for your company week after week, we'll resume this pilgrimage of the Gita series next week, same time, Thursday. Till I meet you all next time, take care, keep safe, Jai Sai Ram.